Pace said hello with a businesslike smile. He was in his mid-40s, dark wavy hair, dark mustache, dark everything. Black denim jeans, black t-shirt, black pointed toe boots. Hollywood at the Willard. Not exactly the corporate look Clay had been expecting. As they shook hands, he had the first hint that things were not what they seemed. With a quick glance, the bodyguard was sent away. "Thanks for coming," Max said as they walked into an oval-shaped room laden with marble. "Sure," Clay was absorbing the suite. Luxurious leathers and fabrics, rooms branching off in all directions. "Nice place." "It's mine for a few more days. I thought we could eat up here, order some room service, that way we can talk with complete privacy." "Fine with me." A question came to mind, the first of many. What was a Washington headhunter doing renting a horribly expensive hotel suite? Why didn't he have an office nearby? Did he really need a bodyguard? "Anything in particular to eat?" "I'm easy." "They do a great cappellini and salmon dish. I had it yesterday. Superb." "I'll try it." At that moment, Clay would have tried anything. He was starving. Max went to the phone while Clay admired the view of Pennsylvania Avenue below. When lunch was ordered, they sat near the window and quickly got past the weather, the Orioles' latest losing streak, and the lousy state of the economy. Pace was glib and seemed at ease talking about anything for as long as Clay wanted. He was a serious weightlifter who wanted folks to know it. His shirt stuck to his chest and arms, and he liked to pick at his mustache. Whenever he did so, his biceps flexed and bulged. A stuntman, maybe, but not a headhunter in the big leagues. 10 minutes into the chatter, and Clay said, "These two firms, why don't you tell me a little about them?" "They don't exist," Max said. "I admit I lied to you, and I promise it's the only time I will ever lie to you." "You're not a headhunter, are you?"
"Nope."
"Then what?" "I'm a fireman. I get hired by big companies to put out fires. They screw up, they realize their mistakes before the lawyers do, so they hire me to quietly enter the picture, tidy up their mess, and hopefully save them a bunch of money. Here's the story. My client is a multinational that manufactures pharmaceuticals, an old, established blue-chip company with a stellar reputation. About 2 years ago, it came up with a drug that might cure addiction to opium and cocaine-based narcotics. Much more advanced than methadone, which, though it helps many addicts, is addictive itself and is widely abused. Let's call this wonder drug Tarvan. That was its nickname for a while. It was discovered by mistake and was quickly used on every laboratory animal available. The results were outstanding, but then it's hard to duplicate crack addiction in a bunch of rats. They needed humans, Clay said. Pace picked his mustache as his biceps rippled. Yes. The potential for Tarvan was enough to keep the big suits awake at night. Imagine, take one pill a day for 90 days and you're clean. Your craving for the drugs is gone. You've kicked cocaine, heroin, crack, just like that. After you're clean, take a Tarvan every other day and you're free for life. Almost an instant cure for millions of addicts. But as you say, they still needed humans. A pause. A sip of coffee. The t-shirt trembled with fitness. He continued. So they began making mistakes. They picked three places. Mexico City, Singapore, and Belgrade. Places far outside the jurisdiction of the FDA. Under the guise of some vague international relief outfit, they built rehab clinics, really nice lockdown facilities where the addicts could be completely controlled. They picked the worst junkies they could find, got them in, cleaned them up, began using Tarvan. After 3 months, the patients were turned loose, with the agreement that they would return to the clinic every other day for their Tarvan. 90% stayed on the drug and stayed clean. 90%! Only 2% relapsed into addiction.
And the other 8%?
They would become the problem. But my client didn't know how serious it would be. Anyway, they kept the beds full, and over 18 months, about 1,000 addicts were treated with Tarvan. The results were off the charts. My client could smell billions in profits.
And the next mistake? Clay asked.
Max paused for a second, then said, "There were so many." A buzzer sounded. Lunch had arrived. A waiter rolled it in on a cart and spent 5 minutes fussing with the setup. Clay stood in front of the window, staring at the top of the Washington Monument, but too deep in thought to see anything. Max tipped the guy and finally got him out of the room. "You hungry?" he asked.
"No, keep talking," Clay said as he took off his jacket and sat in the chair. "I think you're getting to the good part."
"Good, bad, depends on how you look at it. The next mistake was to bring the show here. This is where it starts to get real ugly. My client had deliberately looked at the globe and picked one spot for Caucasians, one spot for Hispanics, and one spot for Asians. Some Africans were needed. We have plenty in D.C. So thought my client. You're lying, aren't you? Tell me you're lying. I've lied to you once, Mr. Carter, and I promise not to do it again. Clay slowly got to his feet and walked around his chair to the window again. Max watched him closely. The lunch was getting cold, but neither seemed to care. Time had been suspended. Clay turned around and said, "Tequila?" Max nodded and said, "Yes." "And Rashad Porter?" "Yes." A minute passed. Clay crossed his arms and leaned against the wall, facing Max, who was straightening his mustache. "Go ahead," Clay said. "In about 8% of the patients, something goes wrong," Max said. "My client has no idea what or how or even who might be at risk, but Tarvan makes them kill. Plain and simple. After about 100 days, something turns somewhere in the brain, and they feel an irresistible impulse to draw blood. Would you sit down, please? I don't like to look up when I talk." Clay took his seat as directed. The next mistake was to circumvent the FDA. "Of course. My client has many big friends in this town. These big people, names now forever lost, found a way to smuggle Tarvan into a few selected federally funded rehab clinics in D.C. If it worked here, then the White House and the big folks would put relentless pressure on the FDA for quick approval." "When this deal was being cut, did your client know about the 8%? "I don't know. My client has not told me everything and never will. Nor do I ask a lot of questions. My job lies elsewhere. However, I suspect that my client did not know about the 8%. Otherwise, the risks would have been too great to experiment here. This has all happened very fast, Mr. Carter." You can call me Clay." "Thanks, Clay. Don't mention it." "Anyway," Max Pace continued, "the drug was pulled 6 days ago. Those wonderful clinics in Mexico City, Singapore, and Belgrade closed up in the middle of the night, and all those nice counselors disappeared like ghosts. All experiments have been forgotten. All papers have been shredded. My client has never heard of Tarvan. We'd like to keep it that way." "I get the feeling that I'm entering the picture at this point," Clay said. "Only if you want to. If you decline, then I am prepared to meet with another lawyer."
"Decline what?"
"The deal, Clay. The deal. As of now, there have been 5 people in D.C. killed by addicts on Tarvan. One poor guy is in a coma, probably not going to make it. Rashad Porter's first victim. That's a total of 6. We know who they are, how they died, who killed them, everything. We want you to represent their families. You sign them up, we pay the money. Everything is wrapped up quickly, quietly, with no lawsuits, no publicity, not the slightest fingerprint anywhere."
"Why would they hire me?"
"Because they don't have a clue that they have a case. As far as they know, their loved ones were victims of random street violence. You will go to them, tell them that they have a case, and say you can get $4 million in a very quick, very confidential settlement."
$4 million, Clay repeated, uncertain if it was too much or too little.
"Here's our risk, Clay. If Tarvan is discovered by some lawyer, and frankly, you're the first one who picked up even a whiff of a scent, then there could be a trial. Let's say the lawyer is a trial stud who picks him an all-black jury here in D.C. Easy enough."
"Of course it's easy.
And let's say this lawyer somehow gets the right evidence. Maybe some documents that didn't get shredded. More likely someone working for my client, a whistleblower. Anyway, the trial plays beautifully for the family of the deceased. There could be a huge verdict. Worse yet, at least for my client, the negative publicity would be horrendous. The stock price could collapse. Imagine the worst, Clay. Paint your own nightmare, and believe me, these guys see it too. They did something bad. They know it, and they want to correct it. But they're also trying to limit their damages here.
$4 million is a bargain?"
"It is and it isn't. Take Ramon Pumphrey. Age 22, working part-time, earning $6,000 a year, with a normal life expectancy of 53 more years, and assuming annual earnings of twice the minimum wage, the economic value of his life, discounted in today's dollars, is about $500,000. That's what he's worth.
Punitive damages would be easy."
"Depends.
This case would be very hard to prove, Clay, because there's no paperwork. Those files you snatched yesterday will reveal nothing. The counselors at D-Camp and Clean Streets had no idea what kind of drugs they were dispensing. The FDA never heard of Tarvan. My client would spend $1 billion on lawyers and experts and whoever else they need to protect them. Litigation would be a war because my client is so guilty. 6 times 4 is 24 million. Add 10 for the lawyer.
10 million?
Yes, that's the deal, Clay.
10 million for you.
You must be kidding.
Dead serious. 34 total. And I can write the checks right now.
I need to go for a walk.
How about lunch?
No, thanks.
Clay saw 12 black faces sitting in the box, angry folks who'd spent a week hearing the shocking history of Tarvan. He addressed them in his final summation.
They needed black lab rats, ladies and gentlemen, preferably Americans, because this is where the money is. So they brought their miraculous Tarvan to our city.
The 12 faces hung on every word and nodded in agreement, anxious to retire and dispense justice. What was the largest verdict in the history of the world? Did the Guinness Book keep tabs on such? Whatever it was, it would be his for the asking.
Just fill in the blank, ladies and gentlemen of the jury.
The case would never go to trial. No jury would hear it. Whoever made Tarvan would spend a hell of a lot more than $34 million to bury the truth.
And they would hire all manner of thugs to break legs and steal documents and wire phones and burn offices, whatever it took to keep their secret away from those 12 angry faces.
An hour passed. He walked along Massachusetts Avenue, sick with the thought that a respected company would prey on the weakest people it could find, then seconds later thrilled with the prospect of more money than he ever dreamed of. He needed his father. Jarrett Carter would know exactly what to do.
Another hour passed. He was expected at the office, a weekly staff meeting of some variety.
"Fire me," he mumbled with a smile.
He browsed for a while in Kramer Books, his favorite bookstore in D.C. At 3 p.m. he walked into the rear of Kramer's, into the cafe, and there was Max Pace, sitting alone, drinking lemonade, waiting.
"Did you follow me?" Clay asked, sitting down and stuffing his hands in his pants pockets.
"Of course. Would you like something to drink?"
"No."
"What if I filed suit tomorrow on behalf of the family of Ramon Pumphrey? That one case could be worth more than what you're offering for all six."
The question seemed to have been anticipated. Max had an answer ready. "You'd have a long list of problems. Let me give you the top three. First, you don't know who to sue. You don't know who made Tarvan, and there's a chance no one will ever know. Second, you don't have the money to fight with my client. It would take at least $10 million to mount a sustainable attack. Third, you'd lose the opportunity to represent all known plaintiffs. If you don't say yes quickly, I'm prepared to go to the next lawyer on my list with the same offer. My goal is to have this wrapped up in 30 days.
"You have a list of lawyers?"
"Yes, I have two more names, both very similar to you."
"In other words, hungry."
"Yes, you're hungry. But you're also bright. Let's not worry about the others. Today is Thursday. I need an answer by Monday at noon. Otherwise, I'll go to the next guy."
"Was Tarvan used in any other U.S. city?"
"No, just D.C.
"And how many people were treated with it?"
100, give or take.
Clay took a drink of the ice water a waiter had placed near him.
"So there are a few more killers out there."
"Quite possibly. Needless to say, we're waiting and watching with great anxiety. Tarvan gives no clue as to who might snap, nor when they might do so. There is some evidence that after 10 days without the drug, a person becomes harmless again, but it's all speculative."
"So the killing should stop in just a few days?"
"I'm counting on it. I'm hoping we can survive the weekend."
"I'm sure you have a plan."
"Yes, as far as you're concerned, a very detailed one."
"I quit my present job, then what?"
Pace pushed the lemonade aside and leaned lower, as if the good stuff was about to be delivered. "You establish your own law firm. Rent space, furnish it nicely, and so on. You've got to sell this thing, Clay, and the only way to do so is to look and act like a very successful trial lawyer."
"How tight is office space right now?"
"We've leased some footage on Connecticut Avenue. Would you like to see it?"
They left Kramer's through the rear entrance and ambled along the sidewalk as if they were two old friends out for a stroll.
Am I still being followed? Clay asked.
Why?
Oh, I don't know, just curious. Doesn't happen every day. I'd just like to know whether I'd get shot if I broke and ran.
My client is very nervous, Clay.
With good reason.
They have dozens of people in the city right now watching, waiting, praying there are no more killings. And they're hoping you'll be the man to deliver the deal.
After a few minutes of silence, they arrived on Connecticut Avenue, in front of a long modern building with a 3-story glass and bronze entrance. Clay looked up and said,
"The high rent district.
Come on, you're on the 4th floor, a corner office with a fantastic view." In the vast marble foyer, a directory listed a who's who of D.C. law.
"This is not exactly my turf," Clay said as he read the names of the firms.
"It can be," Max said.
"What if I don't want to be here?"
"It's up to you. We just happen to have some space. We'll sublease it to you at a very favorable rent."
"When did you lease it?"
"Don't ask too many questions, Clay. We're on the same team."
"Not yet."
Carpet was being laid and walls painted in Clay's section of the 4th floor. Expensive carpet. They stood at the window of a large, empty office and watched the traffic on Connecticut Avenue below.
"What do you think?" Max said.
"I'm not thinking too well right now. Everything's a blur."
"Don't blow this opportunity, Clay. It will never come again. You can do your firm's charter online. Takes about an hour. Pick a bank, open the accounts. Letterhead and such can be done overnight. The office can be complete and furnished in a matter of days. By next Wednesday, you can be sitting here behind a fancy desk running your own show."
"How do I sign up the other cases?"
"Your friends Rodney and Paulette. They know the city and its people. Hire them. Triple their salaries. Give them nice offices down the hall. They can talk to the families. We'll help."
"You've thought of everything."
"Yes, absolutely everything. I'm running a very efficient machine, one that's in a near panic mode. We're working around the clock, Clay. We just need a point man."
On the way down, the elevator stopped at the 3rd floor. 3 men and a woman stepped in, all nicely tailored and manicured and carrying thick, expensive leather briefcases,
along with the incurable air of importance inbred in big firm lawyers. Max was so engrossed in his details that he did not see them. But Clay absorbed them, their manners, their guarded speech, their seriousness, their arrogance. These were big lawyers, important lawyers, and they did not acknowledge his existence. Of course, in old khakis and scuffed loafers, he did not exactly project the image of a fellow member of the D.C. bar. That could change overnight, couldn't it? He said goodbye to Max and went for another long walk, this one in the general direction of his office. When he finally arrived, there were no urgent notes on his desk. The meeting he'd missed had evidently been missed by many others. No one asked where he had been. No one seemed to notice that he had been absent during the afternoon. The best secretary in the office was Miss Glick, a seasoned warrior who might just jump at the chance to double her salary and leave behind the dreariness of OPD. His new office would be a fun place to work, he had already decided. Salaries and benefits and long vacations and maybe even profit sharing. He spent the last hour of the workday behind a locked door, plotting, stealing employees, debating which lawyers and which paralegals might fit. He met Max Pace for the 3rd time that day, for dinner, at the old Ebbitt Grill on 15th Street, 2 blocks behind the Willard. During the steaks and after the first bottle of Bordeaux, Max said there was something else waiting for Clay after Tarvin.
"Something much bigger," Max said, and he actually glanced around the restaurant to see if spies were listening.
"What?" Clay said after a long wait. Another quick search for eavesdroppers, then,
"My client has a competitor who's put a bad drug on the market. No one knows it yet. Their drug is outperforming our drug. But my client now has reliable proof that the bad drug causes tumors. My client has been waiting for the perfect moment to attack."
"Attack?"
"Yes, as in a class action suit brought by a young, aggressive attorney who possesses the right evidence."
"You're offering me another case?"
"Yes. You take the Tarvin deal. Wrap things up in 30 days. Then we'll hand you a file that will be worth millions."
"More than Tarvin?"
"Much more."
Clay had thus far managed to choke down half of his filet mignon without tasting anything. The other half would remain untouched. He was starving but had no appetite. Why me? He asked, more to himself than to his new friend.
That's the same question lottery winners ask. You've won the lottery, Clay. The lawyer's lottery. You were smart enough to pick up the scent of Tarvan. And at the same time, we were searching desperately for a young lawyer we could trust. We found each other, Clay, and we have this one brief moment in time in which you make a decision that will alter the course of your life.
I get the message. I need some time to think, to clear my head. You have the weekend.
Thanks. Look, I'm taking a quick trip, leaving in the morning, coming back Sunday night.
May I ask where?
Abaco, in the Bahamas.
To see your father?
Clay was surprised, but then he should not have been.
Yes, he said.
I'll give you my flights. Just don't follow me, okay?
You have my word.
Great Abaco Island is a long, narrow strip of land at the northern edge of the Bahamas, about 100 miles east of Florida. Clay had been there once before, 4 years earlier when he'd scraped together enough money for the airfare. That trip had been a long weekend, one in which Clay had planned to discuss serious issues with his father and discard some baggage. It didn't happen. Jarrett Carter was still too close to his disgrace and concerned primarily with drinking rum punch from noon on. He was willing to talk about anything but the law and lawyers. This visit would be different.
Clay arrived late in the afternoon on a very warm and very crowded coconut air turboprop.
The gentleman at customs glanced at his passport and waved him through. The taxi ride into Marsh Harbor took 5 minutes, on the wrong side of the road. The driver liked loud gospel music, and Clay was not in the mood to argue, nor was he in the mood to tip. He got out of the car at the harbor and went looking for his father. The wheels came off his father's career when Clay was in college. There was an ugly divorce that cost Jarrett dearly. His firm began to split, with typically all partners suing each other. Distracted, Jarrett went 2 years without winning a trial, and his reputation suffered greatly. He made his biggest mistake when he and his accountant began cooking the books, hiding income, overstating expenses. When they got caught, the accountant killed himself, but Jarrett did not. He was devastated, though, and prison looked likely. Luckily, an old pal from law school was the U.S. attorney in charge of the prosecution. The details of their agreement would forever remain a dark secret. There was never an indictment, just an unofficial deal whereby Jarrett quietly closed his office, surrendered his license to practice law, and left the country. He fled with nothing, though those close to the affair felt he'd stashed something offshore. Clay had seen no indication of any such loot. So the great Jarrett Carter became a fishing boat captain in the Bahamas, which to some would sound like a wonderful life. Clay found him on the boat, a 60-foot wave dancer wedged into a slip in the crowded marina. His father certainly looked the part of the expatriate on the run, barefoot with dark leathery skin and a gray Hemingway beard. He had a water hose in one hand and a sponge in the other.
"Well, I'll be damned," he yelled when he saw his son.
"Nice boat," Clay said, stepping aboard. It was a firm handshake, but nothing more.
"Yeah, owned by a doctor in Boca. You're looking good."
"You too."
"I'm healthy. That's all that matters. Grab a beer."
Jarrett pointed to a cooler on the deck. They popped tops and sat in the canvas chairs while a group of fishermen staggered along the pier. The boat rocked gently.
"Do you still have your condo?" Clay asked.
"Yeah, but I live on the boat now. The owner doesn't come over much, so I just stay here.
There's a sofa in the cabin for you. Hey, I've got a charter tomorrow. You along for the ride?"
"What else would I do around here? Got some clowns from Wall Street who want to leave at 11 in the morning."
"Sounds like fun."
"I'm hungry," Jarrett said, jumping to his feet and tossing the beer can in the trash. "Let's go."
The Bluefin Bar was crowded and loud. A feast was getting organized at a large round table in one corner. Platters of lobster, crab, and shrimp were laid in the center of it. Jarrett motioned for Clay to follow, and they took seats at the table with a half dozen others. The music was loud, the conversation louder. Everyone around the table was working hard to get drunk, and Jarrett seemed determined to lead the charge. After 2 hours, the food was gone, but the rum punch kept coming. The waiter was hauling it over by the pitcher now, and Clay decided to make a quick exit. He left the table without being noticed and sneaked out of the Bluefin. So much for a quiet dinner with Dad.
He awoke in the dark to the sounds of his father stomping around the cabin below.
whistling loudly, even singing a tune that remotely sounded like something from Bob Marley. "Wake up!" Jared yelled. The boat was rocking, but not so much from the water as from Jared's noisy attack on the day. Breakfast was never discussed. Clay managed a quick cold birdbath in the tiny space called the shower. He was not claustrophobic, but the notion of living in the cramped confines of the boat made him dizzy. Outside, the clouds were thick and the air was already warm. Jared was on the bridge listening to the radio, frowning at the sky. "Bad news," he said. "What is it?" "Big storm is moving in. They're calling for heavy rain all day. Gonna have to cancel." Which is just what happened. When four young Wall Street honchos arrived, Jared politely showed them the door. Afterwards, the issue of labor having been resolved, Jared went to the cooler and grabbed a beer. "Want one?" he asked Clay. "What time is it?" "Time for a beer, I guess. I haven't finished my coffee yet." They sat in the fishing chairs on the deck and listened as the thunder grew louder. The marina was bustling as captains and deckhands secured their boats and unhappy fishermen hurried back down the piers, hauling coolers and bags filled with suntan oil and cameras. The wind was slowly picking up. "Have you talked to your mother?" Jared asked.
"No."
The Carter family history was a nightmare, and both knew better than to explore it. "You still with OPD?" Jared asked.
"Yes, and I want to talk to you about that."
"How's Rebecca?"
"History, I think."
"Is that good or bad?"
"Right now, it's just painful."
Captain Floyd came rushing along the pier and stopped at their boat.
"Gunther's here. Poker in 10 minutes. Let's go."
Jared jumped to his feet, suddenly a kid on Christmas morning.
"Are you in?" he said to Clay.
"In for what?"
"Poker."
"I don't play poker. Who's Gunther?"
Jared stretched and pointed.
"See that yacht over there? 100-footer?
It's Gunther's.
He's an old German fart with $1 billion and a boatload of girls. Believe me, it's a better place to ride out the storm."
"Let's go!" Captain Floyd yelled, walking away. Jared was climbing out of the boat onto the pier.
"Are you coming?" he snapped at Clay.
"I'll pass."
It was the last time he would see his father for several months. So much for advice. He was on his own. The suite was in a different hotel. Max Pace was moving around D.C. as if spies were trailing him. After a quick hello and the offer of coffee, they sat down for business. Clay could tell that the pressure of burying the secret was working on Pace. He looked tired. His movements were anxious. His words came faster. The smile was gone. No questions about the weekend or the fishing down there in the Bahamas. Pace was about to cut a deal, either with Clay Carter or the next lawyer on his list. They sat at a table, each with a legal pad, pens ready to attack.
"I think $5 million per death is a better figure," Clay began.
"Sure, there's street kids whose lives have little economic value, but what your client has done is worth millions in punitive damages. So we blend the actual with the punitive, and we arrive at $5 million.
"The guy in the coma died last night," Pace said.
"So we have 6 victims.
7. We lost another one Saturday morning."
Clay had multiplied 5 million times 6 so many times he had trouble accepting the new figure.
"Who? Where?"
"I'll give you the dirty details later, okay? Let's say it's been a very long weekend. While you were fishing, we were monitoring 911 calls, which on a busy weekend in this city takes a small army."
"You sure it's a Tarvan case?"
"We're certain." Clay scribbled something meaningless and tried to adjust his strategy.
"Let's agree on $5 million per death," he said.
"Agreed." Clay had convinced himself flying home from Abaco that it was a game of zeros. Don't think of it as real money, just a string of zeros after some numbers. For the time being, forget what the money can buy. Forget the dramatic changes about to come. Forget what a jury might do years down the road. Just play the zeros. He swallowed hard and tried to speak in a normal tone.
"The attorney's fees are too low," he said.
"Oh, really?" Pace said, and actually smiled. "$10 million won't cut it?"
"Not for this case.
Your exposure would be much greater if a big tort firm were involved."
"Just give me a figure."
Pace was already scribbling something down. $15 million will make the transition smoother."
"Are you throwing darts?"
"No, just negotiating."
"So you want $50 million, 35 for the families, 15 for you, is that it?"
"That should do it."
"Agreed."
Pace thrust a hand over and said, "Congratulations." Clay shook it. He could think of nothing to say, but thanks.
There is a contract with some details and stipulations. Max was reaching into a briefcase.
What kinds of stipulations?
For one, you can never mention Tarvan to Tequila Watson, his new lawyer, or to any of the other criminal defendants involved in this matter. Forget about the murderers. You now represent the families of their victims.
You're on the other side of the street, Clay, so accept it.
Our deal will pay you $5 million up front, another 5 in 10 days, and the remaining 5 upon final completion of all settlements. You mention Tarvan to anyone, and the deal is off.
Clay nodded and stared at the thick contract now on the table.
This is basically a confidentiality agreement, Max continued, tapping the paperwork. He filled in some blanks deep in the contract, then slid it across the table.
Sign it, and I can then tell you more about my client. I'll get us some coffee.
Clay took the document, held it as it grew heavier, then tried to read the opening paragraph. Max was on the phone to room service.
He would resign immediately on that day from the office of the public defender and withdraw as counsel of record for Tequila Watson.
The paperwork had already been done and was attached to the contract. He would charter his own law firm directly, hire sufficient staff, open bank accounts, etc.
A proposed charter for the law offices of J. Clay Carter II was also attached, all boilerplate. He would, as soon as practicable, contact the 7 families and begin the process of soliciting their cases.
Coffee arrived and Clay kept reading. Max was on a cell phone across the suite, whispering in a hushed, serious voice, no doubt relaying the latest events to his superior. Or perhaps he was monitoring his network to see if another Tarvan murder had occurred. For his signature on page 11, Clay would receive by immediate wire the sum of $5 million, a figure that had just been neatly written in by Max. His hand shook when he signed his name, not from fear or moral uncertainty, but from zero shock. When the first round of paperwork was complete, they left the hotel and climbed into an SUV driven by the same bodyguard who'd met Clay in the lobby of the Willard.
"Chase Bank on 15th, Max said to the driver, who was already headed in that direction.
At the bank, a vice president of some strain had been reserved. Max asked for the right person, and red carpets were rolled down every hallway. Clay took charge of his affairs and signed all the proper documents. The wire would be received by 5 that afternoon, according to the Veep. Back in the SUV, Max was all business.
"How do you want to handle the folks at OPD?"
"Let's do it now."
"M at 18th, Max said to the driver, who appeared to miss nothing.
Back to Clay, he said,
"Have you thought about Rodney and Paulette?"
"Yes, I'll talk to them today."
"Good. We can't relax, Clay, until all 7 families have become your clients."
"Seems as though I'll need to tell Rodney and Paulette everything."
"Almost everything. They will be the only people in your firm who'll know what's happened, but you can never mention Tarvan or the company, and they'll never see the settlement agreements."
"But they have to know what we're offering."
"Obviously. They have to convince the families to take the money, but they can never know where the money is coming from."
If anyone at OPD missed Clay, it wasn't obvious. There were a dozen messages on his desk, all irrelevant now because nothing mattered anymore. He quickly typed a letter of resignation and emailed it to Glenda. With the door shut, he filled 2 briefcases with his personal office junk and left behind old books and other things he owned and once thought had sentimental value. He could always come back, though he knew he would not. Rodney's desk was in a tiny workspace he shared with 2 other paralegals.
"Got a minute?" Clay said.
"Not really," Rodney said, barely looking up from a pile of reports. "There's a breakthrough in the Tequila Watson case. It'll just take a minute."
Rodney reluctantly stuck a pen behind an ear and followed Clay back to his office, where the shelves had been cleared and the door was locked behind them.
"I'm leaving," Clay began, almost in a whisper.
They talked for almost an hour, while Max Pace waited impatiently in the SUV, parked illegally at the curb. When Clay emerged with 2 bulky briefcases, Rodney was with him, also laden with a briefcase and a stuffed paper shopping bag. He went to his car and disappeared. Clay jumped in the SUV.
"He's in," Clay said.
"What a surprise."
At the office on Connecticut Avenue, they met a design consultant who'd been retained by Max. A phone system was being installed. A computer consultant arrived after the decorator left.
At one point, Clay was spending money so fast he began to ask himself if he'd squeezed Max for enough. Shortly before 5 p.m., Max emerged from a freshly painted office and stuck his cell phone in his pocket.
"The wire is in," he said to Clay.
"$5 million?"
"That's it. You're now a multimillionaire."
"I'm out of here," Clay said. "See you tomorrow."
"Where are you going?"
"Don't ever ask that question again, okay? You're not my boss. And stop following me. We have our deal." He walked along Connecticut for a few blocks, jostling with the rush hour crowd, smiling goofily to himself, his feet never touching the concrete. He thought of his father living on a borrowed fishing boat, pretending it was the good life but struggling to scrape out a living. He thought of Rebecca, though he tried not to dwell on her. For the past 4 years, she had been the only friend with whom he'd shared everything. Now, there was no one to talk to. Their breakup was 5 days old and counting. But so much had happened that he'd had little time to think about her.
"Forget the Van Horns," he said aloud. "Forget them."
He called Jonah, who was at the computer store putting in a few hours. "I have a table at Citronelle, 8 o'clock, Clay said. It was, at that moment, everybody's favorite French restaurant in D.C.
"Right," Jonah said.
"I'm serious. We're celebrating. I'm changing jobs. I'll explain later. Just be there."
"Can I bring a friend?"
"Absolutely not." Jonah went nowhere without the girl of the week. When Clay moved out, he would move out alone, and he would not miss Jonah's bedroom heroics. He called two other law school pals, but both had kids and obligations, and it was pretty short notice. Dinner with Jonah, always an adventure. Rodney L. Britton found Adelpha Pumphrey at her station, staring at a wall of closed-circuit monitors, but seeing nothing. Her son had been dead for 10 days. She looked at him and pointed to a clipboard where all guests were expected to sign in. He pulled out one of his new cards and introduced himself.
"I work for a lawyer downtown," he said.
"That's nice," she said softly, without so much as glancing at the card.
"I'd like to talk to you for a couple of minutes about your son, Ramon."
"What about him?"
"I know some things about his death that you don't."
"Not one of my favorite subjects right now."
"I understand that, and I'm sorry to be talking about it, but you'll like what I got to say, and I'll be quick."
She glanced around. Way down the hall was another uniformed guard standing by a door, half asleep. "I can take a break in 20 minutes, she said. "Meet me in the canteen, one floor up." Since they had both grown up in the city, they played Who Do You Know for a few minutes. Where did you go to school? Where were your parents from? They found a couple of tenuous connections. Adelpha worked on a Diet Cola. Rodney had black coffee. The canteen was half-filled with low-level bureaucrats prattling about everything but the monotonous work they were supposed to be doing. "You wanted to talk about my son," she said after a few minutes of awkward chit-chat.
"Yes, I work for a lawyer here in town, young guy, very smart, and he's onto something that can get you some big money." The idea of big money didn't seem to faze her.
Rodney kept going.
"The boy that killed Ramon had just walked out of a drug treatment facility where he'd been locked down for almost 4 months. They'd been giving him some drugs as part of his treatment. We think one of the drugs made him crazy enough to pick a random victim and start shooting."
"It wasn't a drug deal that went bad?"
"No, not at all."
Her eyes drifted away, then became moist, and for a moment Rodney could see a breakdown coming. But then she looked at him and said, "Big money? How much?"
"More than $1 million, he said with a straight poker face, one he'd rehearsed a dozen times because he doubted seriously if he could deliver that punchline without going wild-eyed. No visible reaction from Adelpha, at least not at first. Another wayward gaze around the room.
"You jiving me?" she said.
"Why would I do that? I don't know you. Why would I walk in here and feed you a line? There's money on the table, big money. Big corporate drug money that somebody wants you to take and keep quiet."
"What big company?"
"Look, I've told you everything I know. My job is to meet you, tell you what's going on, and to invite you to come see Mr. Carter, the lawyer I work for. What time you get off?" The moist eyes had cleared.
4:30, she said.
"Our office is on Connecticut, 15 minutes from here. Mr. Carter will be waiting on you. You got my card?" She looked at the card again.
"And one very important thing," Rodney said, almost in a whisper. "This'll work only if you keep quiet.
It's a deep secret. You do what Mr. Carter advises you to do, and you'll get more money than you ever dreamed of. But if word gets out, then you'll get nothing.
Clay's raid on OPD had so far netted Miss Glick, the very efficient secretary, who hesitated only slightly at the prospect of having her salary doubled, and his old pal Paulette Toulos, who, though she was well maintained by her absent Greek husband, nonetheless jumped at the chance to earn $200,000 a year, as opposed to a mere $40,000. And, of course, Rodney. To counterbalance the good people, he had hired his roommate, Jonah, who, though he had never practiced law, was a friend and confidant who Clay hoped might develop some legal skills. Jonah had a big mouth and liked to drink, and so Clay had been very sketchy with the details of his new firm. He planned to gradually tell Jonah more and more, but he started slow. Smelling money from somewhere, Jonah had negotiated a starting salary of $90,000, which was less than that of the chief paralegal, though no one at the firm knew what the others were earning. The new CPA firm down on the third floor was handling the books and payroll.
Clay had given Paulette and Jonah the same careful explanation he had given to Rodney. To wit, he had stumbled upon a conspiracy involving a bad drug. The name of the drug and the name of the company would never be disclosed to them or to anyone else.
He had made contact with the company. A quick deal was struck. Serious money was changing hands. Secrecy was crucial. Just do your jobs and don't ask a lot of questions. We're going to build a nice little law firm where we make lots of money and have some fun along the way. Who could say no to such an offer? Miss Glick greeted Adelpha Pumphrey as if she were the very first client to ever enter the shiny new law firm, which, in fact, she was. You may have seen Mr. Carter before, Paulette said, working her way through the rough script she and Clay had put together.
He was in court when you were there.
He was appointed by the judge to represent Tequila Watson, but he got rid of the case. That's how he got involved with this settlement. Adelpha looked as confused as they'd expected her to be. Paulette pressed on. He and I worked together for 5 years in the office of the public defender. We quit a few days ago and opened this firm. You'll like him. He's a very nice guy and a good lawyer. Honest and loyal to his clients. Y'all just opened up? Yes. Clay has been wanting to have his own firm for a long time. He asked me to join him. You're in very good hands, Adelpha. When it was finally time to meet Mr. Carter, Paulette led her down the hall to a large office in the corner. Clay had been pacing nervously for an hour, but he greeted her calmly and welcomed her to the firm. His tie was loose, his sleeves rolled up, his desk covered with files and papers as if he were litigating on many fronts. Paulette hung around until the ice was completely broken, then, according to the plan, excused herself. "I recognize you," Adelpha said.
"Yes, I was in court last week for the arraignment. The judge dumped that case on me, but I got rid of it. Now I'm working the other side of the street."
Clay launched into his version of the big bad drug company narrative, and while it was more drawn out than Rodney's and more animated, it told the same story without revealing much in the way of new facts. "Does the drug company have a name?" Adelpha asked. "It has several, and several addresses, and you'll never know its true identity. That's part of the deal. We, you and I, lawyer and client, must agree to keep everything a secret." She crossed her hands and shifted her weight. "How much money?" she asked softly. $5 million. "Good Lord," she managed to say before she broke down. She covered her eyes and sobbed and for a long time made no effort to stop. Clay handed her a tissue from a box. The black Porsche Carrera rolled to a stop under a shade tree on Dumbarton Street. Clay got out and for a few seconds was able to ignore his newest toy, but after a quick glance in all directions, he turned and admired it once again. His for 3 days now, and he still couldn't believe he owned it. He was 8 blocks from the main campus of Georgetown University, the place he'd spent 4 years as a student before moving on to its law school near Capitol Hill. The lawns here were small but manicured, the streets covered by ancient oaks and maples. The townhouse he wanted to buy was on the market for $1.3 million. He loved the house and the ones next to it. He loved the street, the coziness of the neighborhood, everybody living near each other but respecting each other's privacy. Sitting on the front steps, he decided he would offer $1 million even, then negotiate hard, bluff, and walk away, and in general have a great time watching the realtor run back and forth. But in the end, he would be perfectly willing to pay the asking price.
Staring at the Porsche, waiting for the agent to arrive, he drifted away again to his fantasy world where money was growing on trees and he could buy anything he wanted. Italian suits, German sports cars, Georgetown real estate, downtown office space, and what was next? He'd been thinking about a boat for his father, a larger one, of course, to generate more revenue. He could incorporate a small charter business in the Bahamas, depreciate the boat, write off most of its costs, thus allowing his father to make a decent living. Jarrett was dying down there, drinking too much, sleeping with anything he could find, living on a borrowed boat, scrambling for tips. Clay was determined to make his life easier. Pace's list of victims stopped at 7. 7 that he knew of. 7 that he and his operatives have been able to monitor. Tarvan had now been pulled for 18 days, and from the company's experience, they knew that whatever the drug did to make people start killing usually stopped working after 10 days. His list was chronological, with Ramon Pumphrey being number 6. Clay presented his case to all of them, as far as it was possible, and eventually they signed on the bottom line. The final Tarvan clients to sign were the parents of a 20-year-old Howard University co-ed who dropped out of school 1 week and been murdered the next. After they left, fighting tears, Clay's little team met in the conference room where they let the moment pass and were thankful that no more widows and grieving parents would visit them, at least not in the near future. Some very expensive champagne had been iced for the occasion, and Clay began pouring. Miss Glick declined because she drank nothing, but she was the only teetotaler in the firm. Paulette and Jonas seemed especially thirsty. Rodney preferred Budweiser, but he sipped along with the rest. During the second bottle, Clay rose to speak. "I have some firm announcements," he said, tapping his glass. "First, the Tylenol cases are now complete. Congratulations and thanks to all of you." He'd used Tylenol as a code for Tarvan, a name they would never hear. Nor would they ever know the amount of his fees. Obviously, Clay was being paid a fortune, but they had no idea how much. They applauded themselves. "Second, we begin the celebration tonight with dinner at Citronelle. 8 o'clock sharp. Could be a long evening because there is no work tomorrow. The office is closed." More applause, more champagne. "Third, in 2 weeks, we leave for Paris, all of us, plus one friend each, preferably a spouse if you have one. All expenses paid. First-class air, luxury hotel, the works. We'll be gone for a week. No exceptions. I'm the boss, and I'm ordering all of you to Paris." Miss Glick covered her mouth with both hands. Jonah immediately began debating which girl to take. "I can bring anyone?" he asked, obviously struggling with the decision. "Let's limit it to anyone who doesn't have another spouse, okay?" Clay said. "That narrows the field." "Who will you take?" Paulette asked. "Maybe no one," Clay said. Then the room went quiet for a moment. They had whispered about Rebecca and the separation, with Jonas supplying most of the gossip. They wanted their boss happy, though they were not close enough to meddle. Max Pace wanted to talk, and since the firm was closed, Clay suggested they meet there at noon after the cobwebs had cleared. Only a headache remained. "You look like hell," Pace began pleasantly. "We celebrated. What I have to discuss is very important. Are you up to it?"
"I can keep up with you."
"Fire away."
Pace had a tall paper cup of coffee that he carried around the room as he moved about. "The Tarvan mess is over," he said, for finality. It was over when he said it was over and not before.
"You did good work, Clay."
"I'm getting paid handsomely for it."
"I'll transfer in the last installment today. All $15 million will be in your account. What's left of it?"
Clay raised an eyebrow.
"What do you expect me to do, drive an old car, sleep in a rundown apartment, keep wearing cheap clothes?
You said yourself that I had to spend some money to create the right impression."
"I'm kidding, and you're doing a great job of looking rich."
"Thank you.
Just be careful. Don't create too much attention.
Let's talk about the next case."
With that, Pace took a seat and slid a file across. "The drug is Dyloft, manufactured by Ackerman Labs. It's a potent anti-inflammatory drug used by sufferers of acute arthritis. Dyloft is new, and the doctors have gone crazy over it. It works wonders. Patients love it. But it has two problems. First, it's made by a competitor of my client's, same client as Tarvan. Second, it's been linked to the creation of small tumors in the bladder.
A few months ago, my client bought a small pharmaceutical company in Belgium. This outfit once had a division that was later swallowed by Ackerman Labs. A few researchers got shoved out and shafted along the way. Some lab studies disappeared, then surfaced where they didn't belong. My client has the witnesses and the documents to prove that Ackerman Labs has known of the potential problems for at least the past 6 months. You with me?
Yes. How many people have taken Dyloft?
It's really hard to tell because the number is growing so fast. Probably a million.
What percentage get the tumors?
The research indicates about 5%, enough to kill the drug.
How do you know whether a patient has the tumors?
A urinalysis?
You want me to sue Ackerman Labs? Clay asked.
What will the news about Dyloft do to the company?
Hammer the stock, which is exactly what my client wants.
If the litigation is handled right, and I'm assuming you and I can do it properly, the news will murder Ackerman Labs. And since we have the inside proof that Dyloft is bad, the company will have no choice but to settle. They can't risk a trial, not with such a dangerous product.
Clay considered.
What's the downside?
95% of the tumors are benign and very small. There's no real damage to the bladder.
So the litigation is used to shock the market?
Yes, and of course to compensate the victims. I don't want tumors in my bladder, benign or malignant. Most jurors would feel the same way. Here's the scenario. You put together a group of 50 or so plaintiffs and file a big lawsuit on behalf of all Dyloft patients. At precisely the same time, you launch a series of television ads soliciting more cases. You hit fast and hard, and you'll get thousands of cases. The ads run coast to coast, quickie ads that'll scare folks and make them dial your toll-free number right here in D.C., where you have a warehouse full of paralegals answering the phones and doing the grunt work. It's going to cost you some money, but if you get, say, 5,000 cases, and you settle them for $20,000 each, that's $100 million. Your cut is one-third.
That's outrageous.
No, Clay, that's mass tort litigation at its finest. That's how the system works these days, and if you don't do it, I guarantee you someone else will, and very soon.
Where do I find 50 clients? Clay asked.
Max thumped another file.
We know of at least 1,000. Names, addresses, all right here.
You mentioned a warehouse full of paralegals?
Half a dozen. It'll take that many to answer the phones and keep the files organized, Max said.
Television ads?
Yep. I got the name of a company that can put the ad together in less than 3 days.
How much will it cost?
A couple of million, but you can afford it.
It was Clay's turn to pace around the room and let the blood circulate. He'd seen some ads for diet pills that had gone bad, ads in which unseen lawyers were trying to frighten folks into dialing a toll-free number. Surely he wasn't about to sink that low. But $33 million in fees. He was still numb from the first fortune.
What's the timetable?
Pace had a list of the first things to do.
You'll have to sign up the clients, which will take 2 weeks max, 3 days to finish the ad, a few days to buy the television time. You'll need to hire paralegals and put them in some rented space out in the suburbs. It's too expensive here. The lawsuit has to be prepared. You have a good staff. You should be able to get it done in less than 30 days.
I'm taking the firm to Paris for a week, but we'll get it done.
My client wants the lawsuit filed in less than a month, July the 2nd to be exact.
Clay returned to the table and stared at Pace.
I've never handled a lawsuit like this, he said.
Pace pulled something out of his file.
Are you busy this weekend? He asked, looking at a brochure.
Not really.
Been to New Orleans lately?
About 10 years ago.
Ever heard of the Circle of Barristers?
Maybe.
It's an old group with a new life. A bunch of trial lawyers who specialize in mass torts. They get together twice a year and talk about the latest trends in litigation. It would be a productive weekend.
He slid the brochure across to Clay, who picked it up. On the cover was a color photo of the Royal Sonesta Hotel in the French Quarter. New Orleans was warm and humid as always, especially in the quarter. He was alone, and that was fine. The money was beginning to isolate him. Old friends he once called were now being ignored because he didn't want all the questions. Old places were no longer frequented because he could afford something better. In less than a month, he had changed jobs, homes, cars, banks, wardrobes, eating places, gyms, and he was most definitely in the process of changing girlfriends, though no substitute was on the horizon. They had not spoken in 28 days.
He'd been under the assumption that he would call her on the 30th day, as promised, but so much had changed since then. By the time Clay entered the lobby of the Royal Sonesta, his shirt was wet and clinging to his back. The registration fee was $5,000, an outrageous amount for a few days of fraternizing with a bunch of lawyers. Various seminars were underway. He drifted through a discussion on toxic torts, led by two lawyers who'd sued a chemical company for polluting drinking water that might or might not have caused cancer, but the company paid $500 million anyway, and the two lawyers got rich. Next door, a lawyer Clay had seen on television was in full throttle on how to handle the media, but he had few listeners. In fact, most of the seminars were lightly attended. But it was Friday afternoon, and the heavyweights arrived on Saturday. Clay eventually found the crowd in the small exhibition hall, where an aircraft company was showing a video on its upcoming luxury jet, the fanciest of its generation. Other exhibitors were offering all sorts of luxury items. A boat builder had a group of serious lawyers interested in yachts. An entire wall was lined with elaborate displays of expensive cars, a Mercedes-Benz convertible coupe, a limited edition Corvette, a maroon Bentley, which every respectable mass tort lawyer had to have. The biggest gathering was gawking over a shiny, royal blue Lamborghini. Its price tag was almost hidden, as if the manufacturer was afraid of it. Only $290,000 and a very limited supply. Several lawyers appeared ready to wrestle for the car. As Clay gazed around the exhibition hall, he saw lawyers spending money as fast as they could make it. Was he guilty of this? Of course not. He'd stuck to the basics, at least so far. Who wouldn't want a new car and a better home? He wasn't buying yachts and planes and cattle ranches. Didn't want them. And if Dyloft earned him another fortune, he would not, under any circumstances, waste his money on jets and second homes. He would bury it in the bank or in the backyard. The only 9 o'clock session on Saturday morning was an update on class action legislation currently being debated in Congress. The topic drew a small crowd. For $5,000, Clay was determined to soak up as much as he could. Of the few present, he appeared to be the only one without a hangover. Tall cups of steaming coffee were being drained around the ballroom. At 10, he had to choose between a panel discussion on the latest in Skinny Bend developments and a presentation by a lawyer whose specialty was lead paint, a topic that sounded rather dull to Clay, so he went with the former. The room was full. Skinny Ben was the nickname of an infamous obesity pill that had been prescribed for millions of patients. Its maker had pocketed billions and had been poised to own the world when problems began developing in a significant number of users. Heart problems easily traceable to the drug. Litigation exploded overnight, and the company had no desire to go to trial. Its pockets were deep, and it began buying off the plaintiffs with huge settlements. For the past 3 years, mass tort lawyers from all 50 states have been scrambling to sign up Skinny Ben cases. One of the panelists began talking, and the entire room became still. His topic was the financial report on Healthy Living, manufacturer of Skinny Bens. The company had several divisions, most of which were profitable. The stock price had not suffered. In fact, after each major settlement, the stock held its own, proof that investors knew the company had plenty of cash. "That's patent French," the lawyer next to Clay whispered. "Who's he?" Clay asked. "Hottest mass tort lawyer in the country, $300 million in fees last year." "He's the luncheon speaker, isn't he?" "Right. Don't miss it." Mr. French explained, in excruciating detail, that approximately 300,000 Skinny Ben cases had been settled for about $7.5 billion. He, along with other experts, estimated that there were maybe another 100,000 cases out there worth somewhere between $2 billion and $3 billion. The company and its insurers had plenty of cash to cover these lawsuits, and so it was up to those in the room to hustle on out there and find the rest of the cases. This fired up the crowd. Clay had no desire to jump into the pit. He couldn't get past the fact that the short, pudgy, pompous little jerk with the microphone made $300 million in fees last year and was still so motivated to earn even more. The discussion drifted into creative ways to attract new clients. Oddly missing was any discussion about trial strategies, expert witnesses, whistleblowers, jury selections, medical proof, the usual information lawyers exchanged at seminars. Clay was learning that these cases seldom went to trial. Courtroom skills were not important. It was all about hustling cases and making huge fees. At 11, the local Porsche dealer held a Bloody Mary reception that was wildly popular. Raw oysters and Bloody Marys and nonstop chatter about how many cases one had and how to get more. 1,000 here, 2,000 there. Evidently, the popular tactic was to round up as many cases as possible, then tag team with Patton French, who'd be happy to include them in his own personal class action in his backyard over in Mississippi, where the judges and juries and verdicts always went his way, and the manufacturer was terrified to set foot. French worked the crowd like a Chicago ward boss. He spoke again at 1, after a buffet lunch featuring Cajun food and Dixie beer. His cheeks were red, his tongue loose and colorful. Without notes, he launched into a brief history of the American tort system and how crucial it was in protecting the masses from the greed and corruption of big corporations that make dangerous products. And, while he was at it, he didn't like insurance companies and banks and multinationals and Republicans either. Unbridled capitalism created the need for people like those hardy souls in the circle of barristers, those down in the trenches who are unafraid to attack big business on behalf of the working people, the little people. At $300 million a year in fees, it was hard to picture Patton French as an underdog, but he was playing to the crowd. Clay glanced around and wondered, not for the first time, if he was the only sane one there. 5 years in OPD had certainly sheltered him from many aspects of modern-day lawyering. He had read about mass torts but had no idea its practitioners were such an organized and specialized group. They didn't seem to be exceptionally bright. Their strategy centered around gathering the cases and settling them, not real trial work. French could have gone on forever, but after an hour he retired to a standing ovation, albeit an awkward one. He'd be back at 3 for a seminar on forum shopping, how to find the best jurisdiction for your case. The afternoon promised to be a repeat of the morning, and Clay had had enough. He roamed the quarter, overcome with the urge to stop doing what he was doing. The only problem was a significant one. He had hired people and made promises. Rodney, Paulette, Jonah, and Miss Glick had all left long-time jobs and put their blind faith in him. He couldn't just pull the plug now, take his money and run. He made a profound decision. He would work hard for a short period of time on the Dyloft cases, which, frankly, he would be stupid to turn down since Max Pace was handing him a gold mine. When Dyloft was over, he'd give huge bonuses to his staff and close the office. He'd live the quiet life in Georgetown, traveling the world when he wanted, fishing with his father, watching his money grow, and never under any circumstances ever getting near another meeting of the Circle of Barristers. He had just ordered breakfast from room service when the phone rang. It was Paulette, the only person who knew exactly where he was. "Are you in a nice room?" she asked. "Indeed I am." "Does it have a fax?" "Of course. Give me the number. I'm sending something down there." It was a copy of a clipping from the Sunday edition of the Post. A wedding announcement. Rebecca Allison Van Horn and Jason Schubert Myers IV. Mr. and Mrs. Bennett Van Horn of McLean, Virginia, announced the engagement of their daughter Rebecca to Mr. Jason Myers IV, son of Mr. and Mrs. D. Stevens Myers of Falls Church. The photo, though copied and faxed more than 1,000 miles, was quite clear. A very pretty girl was marrying someone else. D. Stevens Myers was the son of Dallas Myers, counsel to presidents beginning with Woodrow Wilson and ending with Dwight Eisenhower. According to the announcement, Jason Myers had attended Brown and Harvard Law School and was already a partner in Myers